Welcome to the INSS English podcast series, where you can listen to researchers discuss their findings and hear about research in progress. Podcasts address a range of current developments which carry implications for Israel's national security, whether in the international and regional spheres or in the local Israeli arena. We hope you enjoy listening to the multiple and diverse sounds comprising the INSS voice. Hello, everyone. My name is Sarah Foyer. I'm a research fellow here at the INSS, and I'm joined today by Ambassador Dan Shapiro, distinguished visiting fellow at the INSS who served as the United States ambassador to Israel from 2011 to 2017. Prior to that, Ambassador Shapiro served as senior director for the Middle East and North Africa on the National Security Council at the White House. So we have three items on our agenda for today's conversation. First, we thought we'd review Israel's current leading security challenges and dilemmas. Second, we're going to unpack and assess some of the recent policy decisions on the part of the Trump administration implicating the Israeli-Palestinian arena. And finally, we're going to try to size up a bit the U.S.-Israel relationship more generally, looking into the medium and long terms. I think our overarching goal here is to try to take a step back from the almost daily barrage of headlines concerning Israel's neighborhood and try to explore some of the broader underlying issues at play. With the Jewish New Year upon us, it seems like an opportune moment to take stock. So, Ambassador, maybe you can get us started. Try to just give us an outline of the key security dilemmas confronting Israel today, and we'll go from there.
Sure, and I'm glad to be here on the INSS podcast. I'd say over the last several weeks and months, we've really seen Israel grappling with three overlapping security dilemmas, one with kind of an immediate focus, one maybe a short to medium term, and one probably a longer term focus. The immediate challenge has been on the Gaza border, where over the last several weeks and months, Hamas has organized protests and violent attempts to cross the border. Obviously, there have been occasions where people have been killed on that border while involved in those activities. They have launched dozens, if not hundreds, of incendiary kites and balloons and other types of bombs over the border to burn the fields of the neighboring Israeli communities. And so Israel has been looking for a way to shut that down, to bring that violence on the border to an end, but without having to go through yet another round of a full-scale war with Gaza that's fought three times in the last decade. And so that has led it to a kind of Egyptian and UN sponsored negotiation, indirect, of course, with Hamas, to try to come up with some understandings that would quiet down the immediate violence on the border, try to permit the provision of economic assistance that would help alleviate what is a real serious economic and humanitarian crisis in Israel, but also
in Gaza,
but also to maintain the pressure on Hamas and not permit Hamas to gain access to weaponry and other means to attack. Now, that's one of the reasons Israel has wanted to avoid getting sucked into a full-scale conflict in Gaza. There's no sympathy for Hamas, of course, which is responsible for these, is because of the short to medium-term concern, which is on the northern border. Right. That is where Israel and the IDF and Israeli intelligence have been focused for the last several months on Iran's attempt to build a military infrastructure in Syria that would enable it to make Syria a second front against Israel in any war on the northern border. Obviously, Israel has fought wars on the northern border against Hezbollah in Lebanon, the last one in 2006. Many Israelis feel the next such conflict may be inevitable. And when it occurs, they don't want it to also include an Iranian ability with missiles, with drones, with Shia militia, to have a real infrastructure from which they can also attack Israel from Syria. So we've seen many reports of Israeli strikes against Iranian military targets in Syria. Some Israel has acknowledged and taken responsibility for. Others are left to people's imagination. But that is clearly a major focus to try to prevent that new threat from coalescing in the north. And because of that focus and that being a bigger fish for the Israeli security services to fry. They've wanted to avoid getting sucked into a conflict in Gaza. And the last one relates, of course, to the first one, and that is Iran's overall regional ambitions, and including its still clear ambition to achieve a nuclear weapon. This, of course, is of longstanding concern for some time. The Iranian nuclear program is a bit curtailed and constrained by the JCPOA, but of course the United States has withdrawn from the JCPOA, so there are questions about whether Iran will return to enriching uranium, return to trying to pursue that nuclear weapon in the near term, not just over the horizon at the after the agreement sunsets. And of course, Iran continues to sponsor terrorist organizations like Hezbollah, like Hamas, like the Houthi in Yemen, to intervene in the Syrian and Yemen and Iraqi and Lebanese political and security situations. And so looking for ways that Israel can partner, obviously, with the United States, but also with like-minded moderate Arab regimes to put a check on Iran's regional ambitions and, of course, its nuclear ambitions is a high priority, but remains sort of the from the medium to the long term in terms of trying to achieve all of its objectives.
Right. So I want to kind of dig into each of these three challenges that you mentioned, each of these three realms. Let's start with Gaza, because it does seem like, even though it has faded a bit from the headlines lately, there does seem to be buzz about some kind of deal potentially emerging. And as you noted, it would involve, I mean, Egypt has been heavily involved in brokering some kind of an agreement. There are sort of echoes of maybe the Qataris playing a role. And in all of this, though, I have wondered, as many, I think, have, you know, where is the Palestinian Authority in this? Where is Abu Mazen? And what would a potential deal, you know, if Israel and Hamas were able to come to some at least tacit agreement that they're going to, both sides are going to hold their fire for a little while, you know, what are the implications for the PA, which has clearly been very reluctant to go back into Gaza unless they get, you know, their main demand, I think, has been that, you know, Hamas gives up its weapons, or at least there will be, you know, one weapon in Gaza, and the PA would have control over it. So what are the potential ramifications here if the PA kind of gets left out of an ultimate deal?
It's a serious problem, one we've been dealing with, again, through these various conflicts in Gaza over the last decade. After the 2014 Israel-Hamas war in Gaza, Tzuk Eitan, or Protective Edge, the United States tried to work with Israel and Arab states, Egypt, of course, to draft a UN Security Council resolution that would put a focus on reconstruction and rehabilitation in Gaza, but also trying to disarm Hamas. Would take time, gradually, of course, but a big part of that was to insert Palestinian Authority security forces into Gaza, first at the border crossings and then with progressively broader authority into the Gaza Strip. But in the end, the Palestinian Authority was very reluctant to take on that responsibility. Mm-hmm. Of course, Palestinian Authority, Fatah, and Hamas have made several attempts at unification or reconciliation. All of them have failed because all of them have ultimately hit the dilemma where Hamas refuses to relinquish its own military capacity, its own weapons, its own terror capability, and put it under a Palestinian Authority's control. And so partly this is the Palestinian Authority's own responsibility that it has chosen not to take on, perhaps because it's difficult, perhaps because it isn't sure it will succeed, and perhaps because Gaza seems like such a lost cause at times that to take on responsibility has seemed to be something Abbas has really eschewed. But for Israel to sort of manage that border and prevent these flare-ups of violence, sometimes it has no choice but to deal with the power that is in place. Right. It does it indirectly. No Israeli will have direct contact with Hamas, of course, but through Egyptian and through UN mediators, and the Qataris have a role with some funds that they provide for projects and even to pay salaries to Gazans. It's a way of managing a situation. It certainly doesn't solve anything in Gaza. I still believe that to resolve the situation in Gaza. Hamas will have to be uprooted. They will have to be disarmed. Ultimately, we should want the Palestinian Authority to reassert control and to put the West Bank and Gaza back under unified, moderate Palestinian Authority. Unfortunately, that's been difficult in practical terms, but it's also been difficult politically for the Palestinian Authority. And unfortunately, it does have an effect of kind of further weakening Abbas's authority when he's left out of these arrangements, but he's left out in part by his own choice.
Right. It does seem like one of the arguments he and those who sympathize with him have been making, explicitly or implicitly, is that essentially what Hamas wants is a kind of Hezbollah model in Gaza. And that brings me to the second realm that we started out talking about, which was Israel's northern front, what's happening in Lebanon and Syria. You know, yesterday here at the INSS, we had a fascinating conference, a day-long conference on Iran and Israel, where they're headed. And one of the interesting debates that came out of some of those discussions had to do with how Israel will deal with Hezbollah in what everybody presumes to be the next war, whether Israel should treat Hezbollah as a sub-state actor and try to just target Hezbollah in a presumed upcoming confrontation, or whether Israel should treat Hezbollah as Lebanon, essentially, and hold all of Lebanon accountable. And that there seemed to be some quite rather heated debate among members of the Israeli security establishment on that. But more generally, I'm curious what you make of some of these recent developments in Lebanon/Syria. You know, we didn't mention at the outset, but here, of course, Russia has emerged as a key player. And it does seem like, for the moment, Russia has given at least a kind of tacit green light to Israel to try and slow down or degrade somewhat Iran's presence in Syria. But what do you make of Russia's involvement in this now?
Russia's interest is primarily the stabilization of the Assad regime. And they've largely achieved that objective. There were several points during the civil war over the last six or seven years when the Assad regime looked like it was wobbling. Then you had these Russian deployments, obviously very brutal Russian support of Syrian armed forces against various rebel communities, and the facilitation of Hezbollah and Iranian and Shia militia support for the Syrians as well. But I say it with sadness, because I think Assad is a terrible, brutal dictator who should have been gone long ago. Russian project has largely been successful. Mm-hmm. The Russians don't have a particular interest in Iran being able to use Syria as a base of attacks against Israel. And that is among the reasons that they have essentially looked the other way. You said a green light. It has that's effectively that policy for Israeli strikes to try to curtail Iranian deployments that could be used against Israel. We know Iran has already, for the first time ever, acted militarily against Israel with a drone incursion from Syrian territory in February, and with rocket fire against Israeli positions in the Golan Heights in May. So this is no longer a theoretical possibility that Iran might use that territory as a base of attacks. Israel has managed this complicated relationship with Russia extremely effectively. Prime Minister Netanyahu has traveled repeatedly to Moscow, has certainly gotten Putin to give him a hearing and listen and understand what Israel's interests are and the extent, but also the limits of what Israel is seeking to achieve. There is an effective military deconfliction channel between the two air forces to prevent mishaps in the air, but it only works as long as it works. And I know Israeli security experts feel like it's something that has to be constantly managed and tended to, and they can't always be sure the Russian attitude will remain the same. But so far, that freedom of action has persisted. I think it's an important role of the United States to be a voice in support of the legitimacy of Israeli operations and Israeli freedom of action to operate against Iran in Syria. That can be done through public statements, through various forms of reinforcing messages to Russia, to Iran indirectly, and perhaps to Lebanon, Lebanese government as well, to remind them of how much Lebanon will suffer if Hezbollah decides to join this fight. I think that's been the policy of the U.S. under both the Obama and the Trump administrations, but It's probably going to be an ongoing feature of this this neighborhood for some period of time, as long as the Iranians continue to try to make those deployments, as long as Russia is there and present, and at this point permissive of Israel, but always with the ability, if it so chose, to try to impose some constraints on Israeli freedom of action.
So you mentioned the United States, and I want to use that as a kind of segue to this second kind of major issue that we want to talk about, which is, you know, where has the Trump administration been on issues of concern to Israel? And I think one realm that's worth looking at is the Israeli-Palestinian conflict itself. So we've seen since last December, for example, President Trump announcing that the U.S. will now officially recognize Jerusalem as Israel's capital. We saw the U.S. embassy move from Tel Aviv to open its new location in Jerusalem this past May. More recently, there have been some announcements of cuts in U.S. funding to institutions that have traditionally been seen as assisting Palestinians. So some of the examples there, the U.S. is now will stop its funding of about $350 million a year to UNRWA. This is the main refugee relief organization that is run out of the U.N. The U.S. contribution to UNRWA has generally covered about a quarter of the organization's funding, so it's quite a hit that UNRWA is going to take now. But the U.S. also announced that it's going to stop dispersing about roughly $200 million in aid toward development projects in the West Bank. This was money that was generally being given or managed through USAID. Now, interestingly, the Trump administration is continuing its assistance toward Palestinian security forces and organisms on the ground that have been responsible for security coordination between Israelis and Palestinians. This is a sort of side of the story that I think doesn't get a lot of attention, but that has actually shown some real successes over the mm-hmm. years. So with all of this, the overarching impression is that actually, Israel has done rather well under the Trump administration in getting some key demands. But I wonder, you know, is the United States now going to come and try to extract its pound of flesh mm-hmm. from the Israeli side? I mean, President Trump even hinted at this in a campaign rally last month, where he said, you know, Israel's now going to have to pay a higher price in whatever negotiations we may see.
Because of the Jerusalem embassy.
Exactly. Right. So I wonder, I mean, should we expect the Trump administration to come along and ask for something big?
Well, I've tried to make it a policy not to try to predict what the Trump administration
is
going
wise,
to do.
Right.
This is not an administration that operates on some of the same predictable planes that I think some of its predecessors have operated. That's largely because of the president himself. But let me back up a little bit and then bring it forward to some of your questions. There's no question that the administration did make a commitment early on to explore opportunities for some kind of Israeli-Palestinian peace effort. Jason Greenblatt and Jared Kushner traveled the region a number of times, and I think in their first months earned a lot of goodwill mm-hmm. By listening and being sympathetic and trying to think of creative ways forward. Now, I have to say, in fairness to the Trump administration, which I have many disagreements with on many subjects, I do think they inherited a very difficult situation in this realm. We know that Prime Minister Netanyahu and President Abbas have tried to negotiate, or the United States has tried to bring them together to negotiate two or three times over the last decade. All of those have ended in failure. The mistrust between them is deep.
Yeah.
Each of them faces very, very challenging domestic political circumstances to make any kind of concessions. And I think the prospects of any serious peace negotiation, and certainly the prospects of any agreement, are virtually nil in the current political constellation. It's going to take some change of leadership on one or both parties for any American administration to have a chance to succeed. So the prospects weren't good. But then the question that the administration needs to focus on is, well, how can it make a contribution to keeping the two-state solution alive and viable for some future negotiation that might occur after changes of leadership? What steps can the United States take on the ground that shape that environment and when we get to that negotiation, keep it alive and viable? I'm sorry to say one of the major mistakes I think they've made has been the refusal to keep the two-state solution as the defining goal of the policy. They speak about peace. They speak about some Israeli-Palestinian arrangement. They won't say two states, and they won't say that the Palestinians will receive a state. That's context, then, that Palestinians hear or don't hear when various decisions that you referenced have been made. So, for example, moving the U.S. Embassy to Jerusalem, a very defensible thing to do because West Jerusalem clearly is not in dispute. That's where the embassy is. Jerusalem clearly is Israel's capital and always will be. But it should have been accompanied by a clear statement that the U.S. expectation is at the end of the two-state, at the end of the negotiations, the U.S. intends to eventually sponsor. There will be two states and there will be a Palestinian capital in East Jerusalem. Mm-hmm. They were silent on that, and so obviously it affected how that was received by Palestinians and by Arab states as well. Mm-hmm. The same with these funding cuts. Yeah. To say UNRWA is a problematic organization is obviously true. It has a it has sometimes been infiltrated by very anti-Israel propaganda. Also, it has this effect of sort of perpetuating the Palestinian refugee crisis rather than trying to solve it and extending refugee status out for many generations and perpetuating a myth that millions of Palestinians will eventually return to Israel. That obviously won't happen. No Israeli government will permit it. A two-state solution was envisioned so that the Palestinian state could be the place where Palestinian refugees and their descendants ultimately achieve citizenship and sovereignty. And that still should be the model, but that also is sort of absent from the administration's discussion of this subject. Cutting off funds to the West Bank and Gaza, most of these funds don't go to the Palestinian Authority. Again, there's reasonable complaints about Palestinian Authority management, but those funds are designed to help Palestinians in their humanitarian lives, to build up an economy, to provide the stability, frankly, that helps prevent the West Bank from becoming a place where there's even more violence or something that approximates Gaza. And so my experience dealing with the Israeli military is that they really welcome the U.S. assistance. They believe it's a major contributor to maintaining the kind of stability that they also maintain with their cooperation with the Palestinian security forces that you mentioned. So I think there's something out of balance with what the administration is pursuing. They are trying to introduce some new concepts and maybe shape the terrain with certain realities. Jerusalem will be Israel's capital. There aren't going to be, isn't going to be a mass return of Palestinian refugees. That can be, those are not really disputable points, but if they lack the context of what is trying to be achieved, where Palestinians can also see that they can aspire to their aspirations, achieve their aspirations of two states and independence and obviously on reasonable borders and with a capital in Jerusalem, all of these things will fall flat. And the last point I'll make about it is that I think it also complicates the Israel's relationships with the moderate Arab states. Hmm. Israel actually has very workable relations with Egypt, with Jordan, and even with the Gulf states, who it doesn't have formal relations with. They have common enemies, Iran, ISIS, Al-Qaeda, even Hamas, and they make common cause against them. But those countries who may feel ready to treat Israel more as a partner than as any kind of adversary also have internal politics. And those internal politics certainly still connect to the Palestinian issue. And when there's no prospect, and no one is even talking about the prospect of eventually a resolution in which Palestinians and Israelis both achieve their core aspirations, I think it makes it much harder for Arab leaders to embrace Israel in the way that otherwise they might be inclined to start to do now.
Right, this kind of outside-in approach. Okay, well, we'll have to see, I guess. Rumors are that the administration will be unveiling some kind of plan, most likely in the coming months. So watch this space. I think in the last few minutes that we have here, it might be worth zooming out now a little bit and trying to assess the U.S.-Israel partnership, not just in the security realm, but also more generally, and talk a little bit about, you know, how we see that relationship evolving in the medium term, at least. You know, I have sort of sensed in recent months as something of a paradox here in the relationship, because on the one hand, you know, as we know, this is a relationship that for decades has been anchored in overlapping strategic interests, but also shared values as liberal, if imperfect, at times, democracies. And also, it has rested on support for Israel among a wide swath of the American public, generally. So, you know, in recent months, despite the fact that we seem to have an American administration that is very clearly sympathetic to Israel, you also do hear sort of some angst about the direction of the relationship and about some potential cracks in each of those pillars that I mentioned. Now, the crack that seems to get the most attention, at least if the popular press is any indication, is this business of public opinion in the United States, that we've seen sort of decreasing support for Israel among key segments of American society. But I should say also, and this came up actually incidentally, at least indirectly, in our conference on Iran here at the INSS, you know, the pillar that has to do with overlapping strategic interests in the region, I think there are also some concerns that in the long term, given an apparent desire, although things could change as always, but an apparent desire for now on the part of the United States to withdraw somewhat its traditionally more robust presence in the Middle East, you know, are we going to start seeing some cracks, some serious cracks in those strategic interests? Are you fundamentally optimistic about this? Does it keep you up at night? How would you rate your own state of anxiety over this?
I feel like I'm on the couch here. Well, first of all, I'd say that the security partnership remains, I think, essential to both countries and very, very strong. There are major common interests of dealing with the threats that emanate from this part of the world, those that, of course, affect Israel more directly and immediately because of its proximity, but obviously also U.S. interests. So whether that's Iran pursuing nuclear weapons, whether that's Iran's sponsorship of terrorist organizations or the terrorist organizations conducting their attacks themselves, whether it's ISIS or Hezbollah or Al-Qaeda or Hamas. Certainly the instability that has been characteristic in many parts of the Arab world and produces its own security challenge. Managing each of those security challenges is something the United States and Israel have in common and do very well together. During the years I served as ambassador, and I believe it is still continuing today, we dramatically upgraded our joint military exercises, mm-hmm. particularly in the areas of missile defense. We, of course, helped with the development and deployment of major Israeli missile defense systems like Iron Dome, David Sling, and Arrow 3. We've upgraded the military security partnership with an MOU that now provides $3.8 billion. Of assistance. Our intelligence services share information on with a kind of intimacy and immediacy that really is uncharacteristic of anything that we'd seen in this relationship or in previous decades. Yeah. So much of that continues day to day, even a little bit out of the headlines, but Israel's ability to manage those threats and the United States' ability to protect our own interests, our troops, our other allies in this region, very much derives from that security cooperation. I believe that's going to continue in almost all circumstances and under almost any imaginable U.S. administration or Israeli government for the long period of time. That's to the good. Of course, what has also defined this partnership, as you mentioned, are the common values and the bonds between our two peoples. And there one does, I think, still see strong fundamentals, but also stresses and also certain erosions. I mean, for one thing, there's sort of a wave of illiberalism that is taking, having effects in democracies all around the world. We've seen it in Europe. We've seen it perhaps with Brexit and other European countries. I think you hear echoes of that in both Israel and the United States sure. at the moment. And that leaves certain populations in those countries, maybe the ones out of power, feeling a bit more alienated. And so there is a question of what will be the medium-term impact of this very strong identification and partnership between this Israeli government and the Trump administration, mm-hmm. a very polarizing and divisive administration. You know, I've always felt that any Israeli government, any Israeli prime minister, should and rightfully want to have the best possible working relationship with the President of the United States. And certainly the prime minister has tried to do that with President Trump. In this unique set of circumstances, where Israel has other constituencies in the United States that it thinks about, cares about Jewish communities, other minority communities, those not in power who might return to power on the more progressive side of the map, I think it's wise to carry out the U.S.-Israel partnership, including with the president, without seeming callous or without seeming to not recognize the vulnerabilities that some of those other populations feel. So when I travel in the United States, particularly on college campuses and in many Jewish communities, I sometimes hear people say, does Israel still care about the support from people like us? Does Israel still believe that progressives, Democrats, liberal American Jews want us to be part of the coalition that supports us? I think in moral terms, it's wise to maintain that alliance, especially with all parts of the Jewish community. And that means showing respect through pluralism, like the Kotel deal that was canceled, or conversion legislation. It means not believing that anybody who criticizes an Israeli policy sort of falls into the category of an anti-Israel or a BDS supporter, because that's a much more marginal phenomenon. There are strong supporters who also are deeply concerned about lack of progress toward two-state solution, expansion of settlements, and those kinds of things. So I think it's a moral issue. I also think it's a strategic issue. Any Israeli government should bear in mind that there's a pendulum in American politics, and it swings back and forth. And so if people like me, who are in the Democratic Party and the conservative Jewish community, and but on the more progressive side of the spectrum, are going to be successful in maintaining that strong support for a U.S.-Israel partnership that we've had for many, many decades in those communities, we need a little bit of help from our Israeli partners to do that.
Right. Okay. Well, on that potentially optimistic note, I think we'll go ahead and conclude our podcast conversation for today. To our listeners, you're welcome to listen to all of our podcasts by going to the INSS website at www.inss.org.il, where you'll find a featured section for podcasts. You're also invited to sign up to our newsletter and receive alerts for the Institute's various research programs. Thank you for listening, and take care.